Hello, you are listening to Unsound Methods here on Yurt Radio. My name is Damon Blanchett. Each week on this show, I talk science news and play some tunes. You can reach me in real time during the show by sending a tweet to at Damon Blanchett. That's DamonBlanchette, all one word. I should really get a shorter one there. You can also send an email to damonblah@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Facebook. I'll check periodically throughout the show, all three places. This week, I'm doing sort of an industrial theme for the music. That song at the top was Stabbing Westward. Save Yourself was the name of the song. That's one of my favorites. Goes way back to high school days. Actually, a lot of the songs I'm playing today are fairly old. I haven't listened to industrial music in quite a while, so I had to go back. I did find a couple of new ones, though. All right, on to the science. Bit of archaeology news to start with today. Don't usually get too much of that. but it's always pretty cool. In the UK, specifically Leicester, that's spelled Leicester. I believe you say it Leicester, though. Leicester? Could be Leicester, appears the bones of none other than King Richard III were found after being buried and lost for over 500 years. And get this, they were found under a parking lot. Man, you normally think these type of things are found in some sort of temple somewhere, perhaps with booby traps, things like that. Not so for Richard III. The lead archaeologist on the project, one Richard Buckley, who interestingly has the same first name as the old king, has said that these bones are indeed beyond a reasonable doubt those of the English king from so long ago, and not just some random person. The final and most convincing evidence actually came from a DNA test. The team who made the findings, who are from the University of Leicester, compared DNA from the bones to two living modern-day descendants of Richard III, one of whom was the son of a 16th-generation niece of the king. And they matched. Awesome. Using DNA to prove the identity of someone who died over 500 years ago. I think that is just amazing. Even before the DNA evidence, the researchers had a pretty big mountain of evidence showing that this was in fact King Richard. They could tell the bones were of a person in their late 20s or early 30s, had a high protein diet consistent with a privileged life. That means fish, various meats and things like that. And radiocarbon dating showed the bones showed that the person died between the years 1455 and 1540. Also, Richard III himself died in the Battle of Bosworth Field near Leicester in 1485. So the date of the death of the person who whose bones they were died just right for it to be Richard III. The bones also had a large hole in the skull, which is consistent with contemporary accounts of the king's death. According to tracts written back in the late 1400s, Richard III was killed with a halberd, which is a weapon with a long pole and an axe-like head on it. Not a good way to go, I gotta say. He was I'll bet you he was on a horse when he died, and this long axe was probably the best way to do it. The researchers say the most conclusive evidence besides DNA was the very curved spine, showing a form of scoliosis, which indeed also shows up in Shakespeare's play for the character of Richard III. And also, if you go online and do a search for this, it's all over the internet. It was pretty big news, really, because I think mostly because he was found under a parking lot, which is pretty funny. But also, you can see a picture of the bones, both in the ground before they were taken out and then afterward. And you can tell that guy's spine was curved. I believe the article said he could only stand, like, if he could stand up straight, he would have been taller than 5 feet. But because his back was so curved, he was probably below 5 feet when he was actually walking around. Not too much of a scene probably for people. The king kind of looked like I don't know, hobbled over. Might have looked like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Let's see. He was actually pretty young when he died too, I believe. I looked him up a little bit. I think he was in his late 20s or early 30s, something like that. So in computer science news, last week scientists from the University of Cambridge, another one from the UK here, have for the first time created a microchip that allows information to travel in three dimensions. Now, I thought this was already happening, but I guess not. Current microchips can only pass digital information in two dimensions, that is, left, right, front, and back. One of the authors of the paper, Dr. Renu Laverson, an author of the paper from the University of Cambridge, said in explanation, and I quote, "Today's chips are like bungalows. Everything happens on the same floor. We've created the stairways, allowing information to pass between the floors." End quote. Computer researchers are saying that a 3D microchip would allow additional storage capacity by allowing information to be spread across multiple layers instead of all on one, like is the case right now. Trying not to get too complicated here, what the researchers are doing, instead of using charge like current chips, they are using the electron's spin, which has to do with its tiny bit of magnetism. The resulting chip is called a spintronic chip, which are in fact actually already being used in current computer memory. This update brings it into the processor and chip fields instead of just memory. This research is actually true nanotechnology. These scientists are making devices that can process information using spaces only a few atoms in size. It's incredible stuff. Computer technology is just jumping at an amazing rate. And this should speed things up quite a bit. Not just speed, but allow much more storage capacity in the same amount of space, which is pretty cool. All right, up next I got one of the first, most influential, and certainly the most famous industrial group probably of all time, Nine Inch Nails. Its founder, Trent Reznor, is, in my opinion, a musical genius. This guy started out by building his own musical devices from scratch on his own to, I believe, probably in his garage, to get some weird, new, and interesting sounds. This would have been back in the late 80s, actually. In terms of regular instruments, he began by actually playing all of the instruments for a song he was making and then mixing them together at the end. He actually played all the parts, all the different instruments himself, just himself, and the singing. A friend of mine named Skylar has actually done the same and still does it to this day, in fact. And I consider that dude to also be a musical genius. Here's one of the Nine Inch Nails songs, a way older one, one of my all-time favorites. This one's called Ruiner. off the album The Downward Spiral, which came out way back in 1994. That would be 19 years ago. Yes, that makes me feel old.
Yeah.
All right, that was Ruiner by Nine Inch Nails. One of my favorite songs. I remember my sophomore year of college blasting that song out of the windows of my dorm room. And I believe one of my friends who was possibly there at the time is actually listening. You might be happy to know that I just blasted it out of the windows of the yurt. There's a pretty good sound system in this little building. Fun times. Hey, I'm a runner, or maybe I should say a slow jogger. So this next bit of news was pretty interesting, I thought. I've of course heard about this movement of people who say that barefoot running is totally the way to go. It's better for you and your body, they say, and the more natural way to run. There was a Harvard study a few years ago saying it was actually more healthy to run barefoot instead of having shoes on. Statements like this always perk up my skeptic detector. So when I saw some new research had been done, I thought I'd check it out. A group of researchers at George Washington University decided to do their own study about barefoot running, looking specifically at the belief that barefoot runners land on their toes instead of their heels, therefore causing less jarring and damage to your body as you run. They showed that the majority of runners actually still land on their heels, even when they run barefoot. And in fact, it's just the same as when they have shoes on. This was one of the central tenets of why barefoot running is supposed to be better, but the new research showed that people land on their heels anyway. So they're still smashing all their joints in their legs, whether you got shoes on or just barefoot. They did agree that if you do run by landing on your toes first, then it is in fact better and reduces the load on your body. But most people don't do that anyway, with shoes or without. The researchers point out that this is not a definitive answer, as in go to the trash and pull your shoes back out, but it does show that more research is required to really see what's going on. This is certainly something I will have to keep up to date on. Not that I could run barefoot anyway here in the frigid Northeast, especially during the winter months, but maybe I'll try it. Maybe in the summer I'll give it a shot. There's a lot of places I like to run that have a lot of grass. It should be pretty easy to run barefoot on that, actually. And I've actually tried, I'll admit I had shoes on at the time, but I actually tried running by putting my toes down first instead of my heels on my front foot when I'm putting it back down, and it is not easy. You're using, like, all these different muscles. I don't know. I think if I wanted to do it, it's not something you could just go out and just do. You gotta, like, it's almost like you have to reteach yourself to run. Seems like a lot of work, but according to now two papers, it seems like it's worth it. Try landing on your toes when you're running. Give it a shot. How about a bit of an update on campaign spending? I found a new article about this. I know I brought it up back in October or November, but that was just about the presidential candidates' insane amount of spending. But there was a new, numbers were just released with totals spent on last year's election overall, and it's astounding. The first line in the article I read said that the total number of dollars spent exceeded the number of people on the planet. That is, according to the FEC, which is the Federal Election Commission, $7 billion was spent on the election. When you break it down, the candidates themselves, this is for all offices from the president on down, spent almost half of that amount. $3.2 billion of the total. Political parties, mostly Democrat and Republican, of course, spent $2 billion, and another $2.1 billion was spent by outside political committees. The FEC said they processed over 11 million pages of documents having to do with campaign spending in just the year 2012. FEC Chairwoman Ellen Weintraub said, and I quote, "It's a lot of money. Every presidential election is the most expensive ever. Elections don't get cheaper." I find that incredible. Every election is the most expensive ever. Every time we have an election, That is the most money ever spent on trying to get into office. The chairwoman went on to say that she is not concerned with how much is spent as long as it's transparent. She also admits it's not as transparent as it should be, but the FEC is trying. Well, I hope they keep trying. Maybe they should try a little harder. Personally, I think it's complete and utter insanity. There are such better things that $7 billion could have been spent on, like maybe climate change research, things to help climate change. It's just crazy to me. I don't know what, you know, I don't really have an answer, though. I don't know if there should be a cap. Maybe there should be a cap on spending. Who knows? It's crazy. It seems like these days, the people who spend the most seem to be the ones who are elected, although that's not completely true. Not everywhere, but I think in a lot of places. And that's bad. That's not democracy. Anyway, that's not science either, but it's economics. That's a science, right? All right, so up next, I've got a song by an artist that was completely new to me up until a few days ago, actually, by the name of Sleigh Bells. It's a man and a woman, and their sound is pretty unique, in my opinion. I don't know, it's noisy. I'm not sure if anyone listening will enjoy it, but maybe you will. I think it's pretty cool, actually. It's something different. I actually really like it. Here's their song, Tell 'Em, off the album Treats. All right, that was Tell 'Em by Sleigh Bells. Pretty crazy, huh? Some might say it's just noise, but I for one actually really like it. I will probably look for other artists that are similar to that. I like the combination of just crazy music in the background and then like the woman singing. Pretty, it's different. Maybe that's why I like it a lot. It's different from other stuff I've listened to. All right. Now, let's see. So what creates the wind? If you're like me, you would have thought it's the temperature differences in the atmosphere. Hot air rises, cool air comes in to fill in the space. Thus, wind. However, some scientists are now saying that it's more complicated than that. A new paper recently published in Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics brings evidence that the winds that drive atmospheric circulation are actually mainly caused by the condensation of moisture, much of which occurs over rainforests as water evaporates or comes out of the trees. Now, when moisture condenses into big droplets, its volume is reduced, lowering the air pressure, and then this lower air pressure creates extra space for other air to move in, which creates wind. Climate scientists have known for years that condensation produces wind, that it does do that, but they've always thought of it as a small effect. This new research calls into question the size of the effect and what it could mean for Earth's climate in the future. The issue here is that rainforests were a rather large part of the condensation takes place. If the rainforests are chopped down, then condensation will slow and even stop, reducing rainfall and affecting the climate in a huge way. A co-author of the study, Douglas Scheel at Southern Cross University in Lismore, Australia, said, and I quote, "In standard theories, if we lose forests, the rainfall in the continental interiors generally declines by 10 to 30%. In our theory, it is likely to decline by 90% or more." The scientists say that this is because there are billions of liters of water being condensed above forests, and this huge amount of water has a huge effect. Folks, the rainforest must be saved. Not only do they harbor the most diverse life on Earth, but they affect the entire planet's weather and climate. It is bad. We've been chopping down rainforests for many years now, and it's still happening. And the effects of it are really starting to look like a lot more than people thought before. Not only do you end up with huge tracts of land that are just dead, basically, because the stuff doesn't grow right back. It ends up as this sort of tar sort of substance. I've seen pictures. It's like a red tar sort of stuff. Nothing is growing. It doesn't look like anything is even living there in the places where rainforests were taken down. But so what these scientists are saying is that if you chop down rainforests, maybe near the coast, no more water will condense above the forests, and so no clouds will form above the forests, and the clouds will, of course, blow by the wind. And if there are no clouds, then wherever those clouds go, would have gone, is not going to get rain, and so we're going to end up with deserts in quite a lot of places. And you know what? It's actually happened before. The article I read said the Sahara itself, which is obviously now a desert with no trees, nothing like that. There's a little bit of life there, but it used to be a lush rainforest. Now it is not. And what we're doing by chopping down rainforests is accelerating the process in places all over the world. It's too bad. All right, but they also said if you replant trees, if you grow stuff again, then that sort of stuff will come back again. Then more condensation will happen and we'll be able to sort of either slow down or reverse the damage that's already been done. So go out there and plant a tree. The next song up here is by KMFDM. This is another one I remember quite a bit from the college days. Watch out, there's a couple of curses in this one. The name of this song is Anarchy. All right, that was the song Anarchy by the artist KMFDM. That is a classic in my mind. That's another song that came out in the early 90s and also makes me feel old, but a great one. Something about that song I really love. All right, how about a bit of the astronomy? New findings from the Hubble Space Telescope's 2012 Ultra Deep Field have found a candidate for the most distant galaxy yet found. The galaxy formed more than 13 billion years ago, giving a picture of the early universe. Because light takes so long to get to us from that extremely distant galaxy, astronomers are viewing it as it looked like only 600 million years after the Big Bang. The astronomers also found other galaxies slightly closer, but still an incredible distance away. According to the article I read, this is the first statistically robust census of galaxies that are from that far back in the universe's history. The data showed that the number of galaxies in the universe has increased steadily over time, which lends credence to the theory that the galaxies formed by slowly increasing their number of stars instead of forming all at once in like a big burst sort of deal. So you get the Big Bang, then you get all the matter and stuff all spread out evenly, and then, or not evenly, but, you know, roiling around, and then stars started to form, and then the galaxies started to form slowly after that, instead of like Big Bang, boom, galaxies. The astronomers were looking at the red shifts of the galaxies. And for those who don't know what that is, it has to do with the expansion of the universe. Because of the stretching of space from the universe getting bigger, the light waves are stretched, which makes them longer, and longer wavelengths of light are redder in color. Think of a car driving past you really fast. As it comes toward you, the sound is higher, and as it passes you, sound gets lower, like wheeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeee from you, and longer waves mean lower sounds. The same is true of light, but in this case, longer light waves mean red. So the reddest galaxies are moving the fastest away from us and are therefore the furthest away. The light from the farthest galaxies we can see left their stars just over 13 billion years ago, and it is just getting us to us now after all that time. That light left those galaxies before the Earth even, before the solar system even formed. Actually, it's probably before the Milky Way even formed, or at least what it looks like now. This is why we are essentially seeing the past when we look into space. Just looking up at the stars, you are looking into the past, sometimes millions or billions of years into the past. All you have to do is look up. And by the way, if any galaxies were moving towards us, we would know because their light would be blue shifted instead of red. And I still have a bunch of time. That was actually the last thing I had prepared. I did find another article, which I'll talk about, but first I'm going to play another song. This is one I found last night, just randomly playing through stuff. I found out this band Ministry, which yeah, some of it's pretty good. These guys have been going since like the mid 80s. They're still around. But I was listening to a couple of their albums, just to listen to some more industrial music. And this song, Khyber Pass, really stood out to me. I thought it was pretty awesome. So here's Ministry with Khyber Pass.
Thank you.
That was Ministry with the song Khyber Pass, which I heard only for the first time like yesterday, and I loved it instantly. Awesome song. For some reason, I just love songs that sort of sound like that. It's kind of it's big. There's a lot of sound. Although I gotta say, the fade out at the end, that wasn't me. That was part of the song. And I think I've already talked about how much I just hate fade outs at the end of songs. You know, finish your song. It's not that hard. All right, I feel like I'm always missing something when there's a fade out. All right. So maybe you've heard recently, there's been a lot of news out of China about the incredible pollution, air pollution that is coming out of Beijing. Not coming out, but it's in Beijing. I believe it's the worst air pollution ever seen on the earth. And it was just recently happened in Beijing. If you look at pictures, it looks like they're just sitting like sort of in this intense fog, but it's not fog, it is pollution. And a recent study that just came out, literally today, I believe, February 6th, yes, this is today, called Air Pollution Delivers Smaller Babies. A study of 3 million infants across 9 nations, including the U.S., South Korea, and Brazil, finds a connection between inhaled particulate matter and low birth weight in infants. Let's see, the article says, pregnant women who have been exposed to higher levels of some types of air pollution are slightly more likely to give birth to underweight babies. This is from a large international study with results published in Environmental Health Perspectives. Previous studies have looked at whether exposure to tiny airborne particles during pregnancy leads to more low birth weight babies. Many studies have found links between the pollution and the lower birth weight babies, but haven't been able to make a real sort of connection. This is the first time that they've been able to make such a strong connection for this. There's a quote here by Leonardo Trasandi, a children's environmental health researcher at New York University. He says, and I quote, "The thorn in the side of many studies of air pollution exposure and impact on fetal growth has been the variability in study design and in exposure assessment." Because obviously there are a lot of factors that could possibly make a baby be born with a low birth weight. And that's what he's saying, it's been a big problem. So this time they were actually able to really sort of connect air pollution exposure to the baby's size. Now let's see what else it says. A lot of sort of technical sort of things here. In a study of more than 220,000 U.S. births published last month, Trasandi and his colleagues found that outdoor air pollution was also associated with longer hospital stays and greater health care cost. In 2010, 8.2% of infants born in the United States were of low birth weight. Wow. So air pollution is a pretty terrible thing. It's really affecting the health of not only people who are alive, but it appears those who are yet to be born. Amazing. China really needs to do something about this. There's a picture here in the article with some women walking on the street with those face masks on. I know if I was sitting in that kind of air pollution, I'd have one of those masks on too. It's like one of those doctor masks, like your dentist might wear when he's working on he or she is working on your teeth. It's pretty amazing. Actually, the pollution in Beijing was so bad that it went beyond the scale that was previously used for measuring air pollution. There's a scale that scientists use. They give a number to to the amount of air pollution, and the one in Beijing a week or two ago was so high that it went beyond the top of the scale. And it didn't just go a little bit beyond, it was like way beyond. It's I don't know how anybody can even breathe at all over there. Even the masks, I believe, do not give you a huge amount of help. All right. And that brings me to the end of another Unsound Methods here on Yurt Radio. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Damon Blanchett. You can reach me by tweeting to Damon Blanchett, all one word, hitting me up on Facebook, or writing to Damon Blah, that's DAMONBLA at gmail.com. I'm going to finish the show out with a remake of an actually pretty old song called Blue Monday. This is Orgy's version of the song. Same words, same tune, but definitely heavier. I actually like this version better than the original, but that's just me. So enjoy. Have a great week, and I'll be back next week for another episode. Here is Orgy with Blue Monday.
talk instead.
Everybody else has taken it too far. I want you to melt my face off tonight.
Sea Cabbage, Monday nights, 9 to 10. Yurt Radio.
Something to say, but no medium to